Good morning. Let me go ahead and start the City Council study session of Thursday, January 11th. I'd like to excuse the Vice Mayor. A grandchild was born last night, and she went to assist in that and whatever in Indiana. And then Councilmember Griswold is, I believe, on a wedding anniversary, 33rd, if I'm not mistaken, with his wife. So we'll excuse those two. And we have seven items on our agenda this morning. The first is to hear an update, discuss, and provide direction on illegal immigration reform issues. I see you got the memo on the blue shirt. Excellent. That's an inside one.
Well, good morning. Good morning, Mayor.
Yes.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Here today to talk to you about this issue, we have our invited guest, and we're very happy that Special Agent in Charge Alonzo Pena from ICE has been able to join us. We also have Chief Gascon and City Prosecutor John Pombier. The council report, Mayor and Council, goes back to a study session that we held October 5th of 2006, and during that study session, the council asked us to collect some additional information and bring that information back to you. In the council report, we provided an update on those issues, and John and I are ready to answer any questions you may have with regard to that information. If council has no questions on these issues, we will turn it over to Chief Gascon and Special Agent in Charge Pena.
Okay. Questions? I'm not sure which packet it is when I was reading this thing through, but there were some suggestions and some questions as far as some of the different ordinances, painting red curbs, whether that constituted, is that going to be coming up in a different area?
No, or? Mayor, but we can address that right now. We have presented an update on the Herndon, Virginia ordinance, and that was one of the issues council was interested in, and that's dealing with the solicitation of employment either from individuals in vehicles or individuals standing alongside the roadways. That has been challenged in federal court. We will continue to monitor that if that's council's wishes, and continue to update council as that proceeds through the process. With regard to the red curbs, I can turn it over to John and he can tell you basically what we can do at this point with regard to red curbs.
Mayor, at this time, our code allows us to paint certain curbs red and then allow for enforcement of no standing, parking, or soliciting in that area where there's a red curb. If it is council's desire that we go down that road in certain areas, I would request that council ask staff to come back with a few changes to the ordinance to make that process clear. While that is available, it's also available to citizens, but the process is not clearly laid out, and we'd like to work with the Department of Transportation and the Police Department to make sure that we have it clearly laid out so that if we have a curb that we'd like painted, that there's a clear process to follow so the curb gets painted, maintained, and enforced.
Okay. Mike?
The memo talks about residential red curbs. Does that apply to commercial also, or is it just residential?
I believe it applies to both. I mean, it just curbs in Mesa.
You mentioned standing. I didn't think it was illegal to stand anywhere you wanted to, so that's surprised that that was in there. I mean, unless it's for the purpose of being solicited for a job or to be picked up in that area. So,
interestingly enough, where there are red curbs, it does, and where you'll see some signs that say no parking, standing, and. I agree with you to a certain extent, but there are certain areas where they don't want anyone to stand, period. I know that Phoenix did it at one point in between some of the municipal buildings right after 9/11 out of some concerns with that, but obviously that's something else we can look at if council desires.
Okay, so the purpose might be that there is enough flow of traffic that it's to accommodate that or something else, is that okay? And then the process, we have a transportation committee. Is that, do we know, does it come to council? Who would make those decisions? We have other traffic enforcement things on our agenda that they're reviewed by a subcommittee. How does that work?
Let me jump in on that, Mayor. If it's council's desire that staff take a look at the ordinance and make recommended changes, we would do that. We would probably then take it to the Transportation Committee and then get their recommendation and then bring it to full council, but that's up to the council also.
So would it be the Council Transportation Committee or would it be the Citizen Transportation Committee?
I guess I might turn to the city manager on that and how the agenda would be developed.
When are we having that meeting on the committees, on committees? I mean, these are the kind of questions that we really, I mean, we need to work with the council on. On this one particularly, I think as a policy issue of the council, it probably makes sense just to bring it to the Council Committee on Transportation. I don't know that it's necessarily affecting the code. I'm looking for Dan. Did he leave?
It would be a code change.
So maybe it would, maybe it should then go to the Citizens Transportation Board. Dan, you want to weigh in on this
sure.
one?
Mayor and Council, the process for parking prohibitions goes through the TAB, the Transportation Advisory Board, and then on to Council. We'll have specific recommendations. When we apply or when we install signing, there's a specific ordinance that is written for that segment of roadway. For red curb, it's different. And red curb, specifically actually from city code, is included in the no stopping, standing, parking section. So red curb technically means no stopping, standing, or parking. The issue with red curb is it's 24 hours a day, whereas with a sign, you could indicate a certain range of hours if that was your pleasure.
And the committee assignments, the progression going through for red curbs versus the others?
Red curb does not require going any council action. It's handled administratively through the Transportation Department.
Okay. And would you listen to the Transportation Advisory Board and their recommendation on that, or would you just do that internally?
We would do that internally. If we had an issue that red curb was appropriate, typically we use that near fire hydrants and near driveways, 10, 20 feet at a time. Mm-hmm. There are exceptions. You might recall seeing the red curb around St. Tim's Church. There was a neighborhood issue there, and they preferred red curb rather than signing. But typically we'll do 10, 20 feet at a time. We can do more, but again, that's handled within the Transportation Department. Does not go to the Transportation Advisory Board unless it's part of a bigger issue and it's one of the recommendations within a report.
Okay. All right, if I was a neighbor that had some day laborers being picked up in front of my house on the side street, could I then request a red curb, and what process is that? What we're talking about, bringing it through the committee to see how that would work? Would it have to be the whole block? Would it have to be the whole neighborhood? Could one individual do it? How do you have any concept on as far as the law goes? Is there that kind of discretion?
That's one of the things we're gonna have to take a look at, Mayor. I'm not sure that we're anticipating an entire block. What we are anticipating is if citizens come to the Transportation Department and they are interested in a red curb, the Transportation Department is then going to have to go through our process and determine is it appropriate or not. And coming up with that process is what, if council desires, we're going to have to go back and do.
Okay. Tom?
I'm a little confused, and John, maybe you're more, maybe both of you are, I don't know. I always thought the standing part of no stopping, parking, and standing referred to cars. I never knew what it meant, but we're talking about the Transportation Department here. Isn't that what it means? Or do we know?
To my knowledge, standing pertains to cars standing in the roadway waiting for someone, an occupied vehicle.
Right, in the road, right. It's
correct.
A vehicle. It's not somebody standing on the sidewalk behind the red curb.
Right.
And I think that would have lots of constitutional implications if we tried to use a red curb to keep people from standing on a sidewalk.
Yeah, we agree.
Okay.
I'm glad you clarified that because I was confused on what standing meant.
Yeah, I've never seen a case on it, but it's always been my understanding right. that it was wrapped around vehicles and roadways, not sidewalks and people.
Okay. All right. Any other questions on item one? I guess they're both all
Mayor,
on one.
We're going to turn it over to Chief Gascon and Special Agent Chard Pena at this
Please.
Point.
Again, thank you very much for coming and welcome to the Valley here. I know you're a.
Thank you.
All right.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. What I'd like to do today is I'll go through a PowerPoint that will discuss some of the items that were brought up during our prior meeting. Then I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Pena. He has a PowerPoint. Certainly, if you have any questions as go along, please stop me. I'm going to move fairly quickly. Some of the things are, I believe, are pretty obvious, others may not be, so just feel free to stop as I go along. Basically, what we're trying to put is we're trying to put a three-prong approach to our crime fighting, and what we're trying to do is go broader than just simply the immigration issue. We really want to concentrate on what, you know, the criminal things that are occurring within our community and how do we deal with those. And certainly when we have people that are illegally in this country and are also committing serious crimes, we want to use all the tools available to us. The three-prong approach basically that we're talking about is the technology, training, and collaboration with other agencies. The technology piece, basically we have a workforce that is fairly very skillful, has been trained, and we believe that we have the right assets. The question now becomes, how do we take the technology that is out there and put it together with our people and collaborating with other agencies to become more effective? Starting with technology, fingerprint identification, and I will go into more details, data search, information sharing, which would include dealing with ICE and some other agencies, license plate readers, and surveillance cameras. Beginning with the fingerprint identification, one of the things that is occurring in the state now is that the current state system is unable to handle the workload that the state is the law enforcement is creating in the state. So beginning in April of this year, the state is going into a new system, which I've discussed with Mr. Brady, and in order for us to be able to continue to have access on an electronic basis to the AFIS system, we're going to have some system upgrades. And I'll get into the cost a little more later, but basically that's about $250,000 tag that if we do not get into that system after April of this year, we will basically go back to the Stone Age where we'll be faxing fingerprints and using the phone. Some of the other things that we want to do is we want to be able to interface with databases in certainly the Arizona Department of Public Safety, the FBI, and other databases, and that will be the upgrade that I'm talking about that is a metamorpho for our upgrade that the state is going to. Metamorpho also has an additional capability, and that is a wireless fingerprint capability. And we have a, Doug, if you can pass that, there's an inert sample of the system that we're going to pass around. And this is the system that we were referring to, if you recall, when we had our prior meeting, when we talked about the wireless capability from a vehicle. But I have to point out that in order to have that capability, first of all, we have to upgrade our system anyway. And basically what that system will do is it will enable an officer in the field to talk to an individual, and if this individual has been arrested and there is an arrest record, we would ask the individual to insert the index finger. It will be the right index first and the left index finger later, and it will come back, and if there was a booking photo, it's a PDA system, so where you have the little screen there, the information on the individual will come up and there will be a photo, a booking photo that will come up immediately, and we'll be able to tell whether, in fact, the individual that we're speaking to is who he or she says that he or she is. And then, depending on the results of that the return information, if it appears that the person is not who they say they are, or if it appears that they have a warrant or some other, there's a want for them for some other reason, then that will give the officers sufficient probable cause to take him back to the station. You still have to have a 10 fingerprint identification before you actually book someone, but that will be enough to take someone to the station. And frankly, I'm being told that if you get two index fingers identification, you're almost 100% certainty that the individual that is being returned is who he or she says it is, or what the system is telling us that it is.
Can I ask a question on how that works? Is the finger then go into the little slot hole there on top?
Yeah.
It's been passed around, but.
Sure, yeah. It believe me, when I first looked at it, I couldn't figure out how it worked either. So.
Basically, it can be held like this in the officer's hand, and then the finger goes in this little slot.
Okay.
There's a laser reader in here. It's inert, but the fingers just go in there, and then it's done by its PDA, and just a few clicks. That transmits from this device to the mobile unit, the car, which in turn turns around and does a transaction with the rest of the system.
Okay, thanks. Scott.
Quick question on that too. The in order to identify somebody,
you have a seat so we can turn the mic there.
I'm sorry.
In order to identify somebody, they would have had to have been arrested previously, booked, fingerprinted, that type of thing?
Yes, there has to have been a record created.
So FBI record, military record, anything like that would work?
Depending upon which database that we are hooked into, yes, sir.
Yeah, but generally, you won't get military records. You will get anything that is in the NCIC system. So they, if they have been arrested, they have been booked, their fingerprints have been taken, they have been photographed, that's the kind of information that you're going to get back in this system.
So a typical mother who never served in the military,
it will come back no record. And that, I mean, that's a good thing. We have someone that at least there is no record of an arrest and the booking. Now, one of the things about the system, by the way, this system, again, the state of Arizona is a little behind in some of these areas. Even though when they go to the Metamorpho upgrade in April, this particular system will not be enabled probably until the last quarter of 07. And what we're going to request from you is that if you give us approval, that we'll hold the money and the approval in advance until the system, in fact, is operating before we actually purchase the system. It is operating in other parts of the country, but not here. But that's not it. That's not anything that we control here in the city. That's a state problem. Okay. Basically, what you see there is a schematic of what we have just been talking about, how the system works, you know, the input of the information, how it goes through the different databases, and then giving you back a response. COPLINK is the next piece of technology that we're looking at. And COPLINK is basically it's a data mining software system that is being used throughout the country very successfully. And what it does is it takes disparate databases, searches for information parameters, and in a matter of seconds, it provides back feedback as to any potential linkage between what appears to be information that could be in disparate databases. So let's say that we have a crime that occurred and the officer has a partial license plate, possibly a nickname of a suspect, maybe a tattoo, or some other minor identifier. The officer can put this information into the system, and the system will very quickly start searching through all the databases that it's hooked up to. So it will be searching through arrest records, field interview records, citations, any system that we hook them up with. And in a matter of seconds, it will come back and it will start giving you the linkage between, let's say, a vehicle with a 123 number in the license plate and somebody with the nickname of Joe, or somebody with a tattoo of an eagle on the right arm. It will start bringing those things, and then it will also do not only it will do a spatial linkage. So for instance, if you have a Joe with the eagle tattoo and driven a vehicle with a 123 in Tucson and one in Phoenix, it will give you the Phoenix linkage first and then the Tucson, so it shows a spatial relationship to where you're asking for the information, in this case being Mesa. This is a very powerful tool that frankly, if you were doing a manual search for this information, this is the kind of stuff that years ago or even today you will have a big task force and they will be doing something like a serial killer or something. It's not the kind of stuff that we would normally do on a day-to-day operation. What this does is it gives a tremendous tool to police officers and detectives to conduct investigations very quickly, and quite frankly, it really allows us to bring us into the 21st century in terms of criminal investigation. What is going on with the system here is the system is already in the valley in some areas. Phoenix has already put one. It's not working. The value of the system is the more agencies that you link to the system. We have been in conversations and negotiations with COPLINK because I work with them in LA, and the desire here is to make Mesa a node. And I'm meeting with all the other chiefs in the East Valley, and what we're hoping to do is create a collaborative so that we'll have all the local agencies hooked up, because we know that our bad guys do not respect jurisdictional boundaries, and we may have a guy that is being stopping other neighboring cities, and we may not know of the information. And the advantage of using a system like COPLINK is that it will put us all in the same database system, and we'll be able to share information, not only arrests, but with another system that I'm going to discuss in a moment, we'll be able to discuss even simple traffic stops, field interview cars. It's just a very powerful tool that policing can very quickly start looking at people that are repeatedly being stopped by the police, and we can start putting information that will be seemingly unlinked or seemingly not connected and start putting it together in order to solve crimes. And it's a very, very powerful tool. And again, this is just a scheme, and this is a sample of Orange County in California, how the system is working with the various agencies that are being hooked up, and that's only for illustration purposes. You can see coming from a vehicle, it could also go from a PDA. In fact, it could be used from a simple system as a BlackBerry. license plate readers, that's another technology, and this is technology that we're currently using in Mesa in combination with other agencies here, and we want to extend the ability of using license plate readers. This is another tool that provides a tremendous amount of information for us and the ability to recover stolen vehicles, especially when we're talking about understanding that there is a problem here with sometimes vehicle being stolen and taken across the border. It just really helps in fighting that problem. Here's an illustration of what the license plate readers have done for the city of Mesa. Since September of 2005, when we started deploying as a partner, but just in the city of Mesa, we've deployed it for approximately 581 hours. That's the total number of reads. And as you can see, that's how many vehicles have been recovered and the value of recovery of the vehicles and the number of arrests. And that is something that, quite frankly, requires almost no work from the officer because the system is just reading plates as the officers are driving around. And then, of course, once it makes a hit, then the officer will follow with it, stop, and do take appropriate action. InfoCop is another piece of technology that would work in conjunction with CopLink. Now, unlike CopLink, CopLink is already a proven product that has been in the market for a while. InfoCop is a newer product. There are some agencies that are using it already, but it's still in some areas it could be somewhat experimental, but it's a piece of equipment that we want to work with, and the company is willing to work a partnership with us and allow us to be a beta site and test the product. And what InfoCop does basically is it takes, you scan driver's license, you scan identifications, or you can type it in, and it very quickly creates a field interview card. Also, any time that we take a report, it goes into our records management system, and it sucks that information and puts it on a separate server so that it can work with a system like CopLink to do the data mining, and it does it in a seamless basis, and it works very fast. So, for instance, if we take a traffic report, if we take a crime report, or if we take a citation, or certainly if we do a field interview, it puts all this information in the database with all the fields that particular form or that database had. So when you, let's say that you have a vehicle, a traffic citation, you have a description of the vehicle, you have a description of the suspect, name, and all that information, it goes into the database. Now, later on, if you use a system like CopLink, and let's say that you're looking for somebody with the name of Joe and driving a vehicle that had a 123 license plate, well, it will search through the traffic citations, and all of a sudden, guess what? Joe or a Joe will stop, and it had a license plate 123ABC, and it will stop and written a citation in Mesa several months ago. That will be an investigative lead now to the officers. We got an individual that will stop here. This is more information on this individual that's a possible match to what we're looking here, and let's say an aggravated assault or a robbery or some other investigation. Again, this is information that normally would go unnoticed by police because we don't have the capabilities today of searching all these bases and putting it together. Then, of course, we're talking about surveillance technology, and this is an area that we still are working on. We're exploring this technology. Obviously, there will be additional costs. As a matter of fact, I met with the Downtown Association yesterday at the Tribune. There's a desire for local businesses to actually start perhaps funding some cameras around the downtown area and doing a pilot program and working in partnership with us. So we're looking for ways also to get some of this technology and reduce the cost to the city, and that will be an example of maybe using local businesses to actually fund some camera technology and working with us. Training will be a critical part of this, of course, and there are several things that we'll be doing. We'll also be providing, obviously, training in this equipment if council were to allow us to use it. But there was another thing that we talked about, and that was providing training on the identification of false documents, fraudulent IDs, driver's license. And we went forward with the direction of council, and we're actually conducting regional training in February. We're working with the Department of Public Safety and the Phoenix Police Department, and we will be the host agency for training in this area, which will be obviously for our people, but also other people in the region, and that's gonna take place in February of 2007. Collaboration, obviously Mr. Pena is here today. We're continuing to enhance our collaboration with ICE, and one of the things that Mr. Pena has agreed to do is to provide us with a single point of contact for all of our criminal investigations so that we can ensure that 24/7, if we're investigating a crime and we believe that we have someone that would be subject to the jurisdiction of ICE. We'll be able to call upon them, and we will have someone immediately available to us. Another thing that we're doing is that we're ATF, starting in February, will be embedding two agents here in the city of Mesa, and this is the first time where we have permanently embedded federal agents here. ATF will be working with two of our street crime units, the one in Central and one in Dobson, and we're also exploring other similar partnerships with DEA at this point. Also, by going into the COP link, InfoCop configuration, we'll be able to draw not only from local databases, but because once we get into the COP link mode, our node will be able to communicate with Orange County, Los Angeles, and eventually Las Vegas. And we know that a lot of our gang problems are certainly coming from their Southern California area. Continuing talking about the collaboration, we're active participants in the state's gang immigration intelligence team enforcement mission, and that's one of the areas that we have ongoing communication, and we continue to enhance that process to work with the state and work with other agencies. Talking about the fiscal impact, as I indicated to you earlier, there's two pieces to the Metamorpho upgrade having to deal with fingerprints. One of them is the one that we must do in order to continue to have access on the electronic basis, starting with April this year with the state and fingerprints, and that's going to cost approximately $250,000, $230,000, give or take. The other piece is the wireless configuration from the car, and we believe that will be somewhere in the neighborhood of around $50,000. What we would like to do is, if you give us approval to that, is that we would hold that second piece for the wireless communication up until the point where it's actually a functional technology in the state, and then when it is, then we would proceed with a purchase. License plate readers, we're suggesting that we like to purchase four units. That will be one unit per station at this point. We're also pursuing grant funding to seek any additional units, but our goal is to have at least one for each of our stations. In addition to that, I was just contacted by the Police Executive Research Forum yesterday. We have been in partnership with them, and they have been doing a study of Mesa, which is supposed to be coming semi-final draft by the end of this week. And we have had discussions, and they've asked us if we want to participate and a license plate reader study for 1 year, and I have agreed to do so. And one of the things that we will get from that partnership will be that they will probably fund one license plate reader for us, and then they will be collecting the data. We will be sharing the data we're collecting from this and looking at the effectiveness of this technology in fighting crime. So that will be advantageous to us for two reasons. One, we will get one reader, and two, we'll have be able to work on a national level in studying the actual impact of this technology that is, although it's not brand new, it's not cutting edge, but it's fairly recent in the U.S. And then, of course, COPLINK is something that I'm working with the manufacturer in looking at developing a consortium where we would actually agree to do some of the studies with them, work on the beta side with them, and the development of technology. And the trade-off will be that we will work some accommodations in the price of the technology. If we were to buy the technology and pay the regular price today, and probably hooking up to the four or five major databases that we would want to be hooked up to, it would be about an $800,000 cost. I believe that we can reduce that price significantly by agreeing to do some other information sharing partnerships. InfoCop will come in on a pilot basis initially. We're looking at a pilot of 180 days where they will basically pay for all the services, the software, the hardware, and then at the conclusion of that, if we decide that we want to keep the system, there are discussions about how they would help us seek grants in order to fund most of this technology. And that completes my part of the PowerPoint presentation. And I don't know if you have any questions, or would you like me to continue and have Mr. Pena with his presentation?
Let's take a couple of questions here. Okay. Kyle?
How much overlap is there between the InfoCop and the, anyway, you got two separate programs.
Right, the COP link and the InfoCop.
The COP link and the
InfoCop. Yeah, they're really complementary to each other. There is no overlapping. COP link is a data mining system. So COP link will go into this separate database. If you can think of Google, that's basically what COP link will do.
A Google for COPs.
Yeah, exactly. It will just go, exactly. It's a Google for COPs. It will just, whatever databases you hook it up to, even though they may be disparate databases, you may have legacy systems that normally would not talk to one another, this system will punch through it, will pick up the information that seems to be connected and bring it up, and it will prioritize it for you. What InfoCop will do is actually create the databases. It will start putting information on the server, and it will do it in a very, very fast fashion. For instance, with a driver's license, one of the things that we would have scanners in the vehicle, and the officer, rather than having to be typing information or taking, the officer would just simply swipe the driver's license. Now, it does two things when you swipe the driver's license. Not only does it collect the information, and it gives you the most recent information that the state has. So let's say that the actual plastic card has an address, but the person not, you know, moved somewhere else and they have already sent a change of address, it may not be reflected on the actual document. But it also does another thing. If it's a fraudulent driver's license, it would tell you immediately it's a fraudulent driver's license, because when they read it, it will determine that it's not a good driver's license. So for what happens on a typical traffic stop, you know, the officer asks for ID, they get it, they look at it. Sometimes they may complete a field interview car, sometimes they may not. Even if they do, if it's done by hand, then someone else has to go back and pound that information into the system. And quite frankly, we're very, very far behind. Most of that information does not end up being captured. Well, with this system, you're swiping that information, is immediately going into the database, and all the officer now has to do is put a small narrative about the reason for the why the stop took place, and it will go into the database. It will also go into our records management system, and it will take crime reports and all that stuff and put them into this new data warehouse, which will facilitate a system like Copland coming in then and sweeping through it and picking up information.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
On a more of a global scale, do we know who's in the United States? Who are citizens? Who are registered drivers? Is all of that database part of your COPLINK too? Is your underlying COPLINK basis?
COPLINK will be able to go into any database that is given access to. Traditionally, what is happening is COPLINK will be given access to NCIC information, which is a National Crime Information System, which basically will capture people that are wanted, vehicles that are wanted, that type of information. It will go into our arrest, crime and arrest information at the state level. We would want to eventually get into our citations. Anytime you hook into a new database, obviously there's additional costs because there's additional system adjustments that have to be made. But traditionally what you do is you go into a crime and arrest, you go into the state databases for crime and arrest, you will go into traffic citations, you will want to go into field interview cars. Now if you hook up into other nodes, let's say that once we have our node, we'll get an automatic hookup to Phoenix, we'll also have access to everything Phoenix has. If you have Southern California nodes, COPLINK will hook us to those other nodes, so we'll also have access to whatever those Southern California systems have. To go into a ICE database, COPLINK at this point is not going in there, and I would have to let Mr. Pena speak to who has access to that database.
And I guess what I'm asking is, what triggers someone even being accessible to your database?
It would be generally in the crime and arrest, obviously.
Accessible is not the right word. Why would anyone be in the database versus outside?
Okay.
If a birth certificate obviously does not trigger that you're in the database.
Right.
A death certificate doesn't take you out. It's not going to be then for a passport if you're in the country or out of country. I'm trying to figure out to what level and where we're headed with this.
Currently, what this is going to be headed to is it will give us anybody that has been arrested. It will give us anybody that has filed a crime report. It will give us anybody who has been on a vehicle stop with a police officer where a field interview car was completed and it was put into a database, in a field interview database. It will give us people that have been cited. Those are the major databases that we'll get access to. The system is capable of going into any database that is given access to.
Okay, if somebody's cited, though, what information do you need in order to put a legitimate entry into your database? Do you need...
Just a ticket. I mean, you write a citation.
Is it linked in with...
With fingerprints?
Fingerprints or eye scans or anything else, or...
Coupling actually doesn't get into that. Coupling goes into the name and the physical descriptors and the time and the place and the vehicle. It's an investigative tool. What coupling is basically is a pointer system. It says, hey, you're looking for someone that has this characteristics. We have a whole bunch of people that have been in contact with the police for a variety of things that meet these characteristics. Then the detective then has to go out and do the work. The important thing about why the value of this tool is most criminals are repeat offenders. There are very few people that commit a single crime and that's all they do. Criminals get stopped for traffic violations. Criminals get involved in traffic accidents. Criminals get stopped for field interview cars. They are accompanied by other people. What Coplink does is it brings that information to say, we have people that have been in police contact before that may meet the characteristics that you're looking for, and then the detective will go out and do the follow-up investigation.
Okay, so as long as they're driving or you have some type of probable cause to ask for identification, then you can...
Correct. I mean, so they get placed in the database through some type of a contact,
okay.
And then we're doing the follow-up investigation on a related event, and basically brings all that information up. It's just a tremendous tool for solving crime.
Right. You also mentioned if somebody's reporting a crime. If somebody's reporting a crime, do you get ID and verify who they are as that is being reported? So if I'm filling out a crime report, I was burglarized.
Right. We ask for identification generally to complete the crime report. That's correct.
Okay.
Now, bear in mind, though, that it's not a requirement. Let's say that I get burglarized and I call the police, we go there and say, I don't have any identification, but my house was burglarized. We'll take at face value whatever we want to take the crime report, so we'll take it and take whatever name they're giving us.
Okay. Does this link internationally? Do we link into information that we may receive from any foreign countries?
Well, the system is capable of doing so. It isn't at this point because you have access protocols. I mean, all different databases, and I'll let Mr. Pena go into it, but I mean, they have their own protocols as to how people can access their database. So the system only has the level of accessibility that the agency that owns the system has. There are a lot of databases that we don't have access to, and we wouldn't because of security reasons.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Scott?
Yeah. One more question, Scott?
A couple.
Yeah, okay, sure.
I want to step back over into the fingerprinting technology that we were talking about. I had asked if it would download or identify somebody who hasn't been in the system, and obviously the answer is no. So the other question popping into my mind is the reverse. Can that system be used to upload somebody? So if you stop somebody who has no ID, you identify that person, can you upload their ID and fingerprint into the system, or is that just a one-way?
Yeah, it's a one-way, because remember that the fingerprint, the AFIS system is based on police having had the reason to fingerprint someone and legally do so. Making a stop on the field doesn't give the police or the state the right to put somebody's fingerprint in file. What it will do is, you know, obviously if you've been arrested, if you apply for a license, let's say you want to teach or you want to be an attorney, I mean, there's certain professions, a police officer, your fingerprints will go on file. So those systems, it will search and take, but it will not do the reverse.
Okay, that was important. And a little bit on the collaboration effort, you had mentioned that ATF agents are going to be embedded with the Mesa Police Department. Can you talk to me a little bit about the scope and purpose of that?
Yes.
Program.
Yes. During the reorganization of the department, if you recall, I took most of our detectives and put them in our stations. Part of that is that we created our street crime units. Street crime units are composed of our gang officers, detectives, narcotics. They're all working together. And basically the concept is that bad guys generally do multiple things, and we don't care how we get them so long as we get them. One of the things, too, is that we know that bad guys usually use guns, and generally the guns that they use, they don't own legally, or they are not supposed to have the guns. ATF
has access to a national databases and also tools that we do not have. They're experts in dealing with gun-related crimes. We know that most of our gang members and many of our narcotics suspects also use guns. Bringing ATF and embedding them with our unit, what it does is it gives us immediate federal access to all the capabilities that ATF has. It is a model that I used before in LA very successfully. We use it against gangs. Quite frankly, we have many more agents embedded in LA, but obviously the scope of the agency is different. This is a test process. We've never done this. We have loaned people to other agency task forces, and we do so on a regular basis. This is the reverse. We're bringing other people here to work with us. And we believe that there's enough work here in Mesa, unfortunately, that will be cost effective for ATF to do so. And through personal contacts, they have agreed to do it. And as a matter of fact, I'm having both the special agent in charge of ATF in Phoenix and one in LA are participating on our CompSat today. They will be there at 10 o'clock today to work with us.
That's going to be an interesting program because a lot of our burglaries are a result of drugs.
Absolutely.
So I think that's going to have some positive impact.
It will. And, you know, one other piece of that, of course, is it gives us direct access to the U.S. attorney and federal prosecutions. And in some cases, the federal statutes carry the penalties under the federal statutes are much greater than the state. And so it's...
ATF doesn't have jurisdiction over immigration law. That would be ICE, correct? Right. So I guess the question I'll pose, and I'll just leave it open. You don't have to answer it, but... Maybe you, special agent,
yeah.
In charge, you can direct your presentation toward the idea of could we have a similar relationship with ICE where we have embedded ICE agents here in Mesa for the purpose of illegal immigration, addressing those issues. And you don't have to answer that now, but it's maybe sure. As part of your presentation that may already be in here, I don't know, which is why I asked that question. The license, I'm sorry, the fingerprint package is at the $275,000 on the fiscal impact, $275,000. How many of those were we going to buy?
We're looking at buying 10.
Ten.
Yeah, 10 at this point.
Yeah. And how would that spread out? Two per station?
Probably two per station and two that were given to special investigations. And the goal, obviously, is as the technology evolves, is to have more on the field. But this is still, I mean, like I said, the state of Arizona today, if we bought them today, we can use them because Arizona is not quite there yet. Other states are. So we want to make sure that we move, but we also want to do it thoughtfully because we want to make sure that the technology is going to work well in the state. It wouldn't do us any good to buy a bunch of them and then they become paperweights.
Okay. Well, the good news is that answer killed my other three questions, so
okay.
We could go on. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Should we go on with the...
Please.
Okay.
Good morning, and I want to thank the mayor and the council, the chief, and the public that's here today to hear about immigration and customs enforcement. I know it's a very important issue, immigration is, and hopefully today I will be able to tell a little bit about our organization and then also to talk a little bit about, as the chief pointed out, his three-prong approach, the collaborative efforts that we have with the Mesa Police Department. So first of all, just an overview of would be, you know, as ICE, the entity of ICE, and a little bit of history about ICE, we became part of Homeland Security. They took the Customs Service and they took the Immigration Service and merged just into one agency. They took all the investigators, the special agents from Immigration and all the special agents from U.S. Customs Service and made ICE, and that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The uniformed people went to another division. The Border Patrol and the Customs Inspectors are a totally different organization and report to a totally different chain of command. ICE's mission is to protect the American public and uphold public safety by targeting people, money, and materials that support terrorist and criminal activities. And I want to emphasize, and it'll go through in my presentation, that we are investigators. What we do, what ICE agents do, is do criminal investigations. There's in ICE, again, it's Immigration Customs Enforcement, there's several operational divisions. The one that I'm in charge of is the Office of Investigation, special agents that do federal prosecutions with the U.S. Attorney's Office of criminal cases. There's also another division of ICE that I do not supervise, but it's here in Phoenix, and they're the people that do detention and removals. When an alien is, or someone, an undocumented person is discovered in the U.S. or through, and he's here, there's another division of ICE that is in charge of removing that person, processing and deporting that person, or doing a voluntary removal. We also have the Office of Intelligence, which does a lot of our threat assessments and works to provide us case support. Our attorneys, the Office of the Principal Legal Advisor, and then Federal Protective Service. That's kind of a unique thing, that when they made Homeland Security, you had this agency that was under a GSA, and they didn't know where to put them. So they're the guards at the federal buildings and the courthouses, and they're part of ICE also. But that's, they're under a totally separate chain of command. I will emphasize, I'm the special agent in charge of the Office of Investigations. And again, the Office of Investigation, we have a wide range of activities. When you look at all the responsibilities that agents from immigration have and all the responsibilities that agents from customs has, and you merge those responsibilities and authorities into one agency, we have an awesome responsibility and authority. This is the structure of the Phoenix Special Agent in Charge office. We have an office here in Phoenix, and we have offices along the border in Tucson, Douglas, Nogales, and Sells. You know, the majority of our agents are, I mean, we're kind of pretty much split up. We're about half and half. Half our agents are on border offices, and then the other half is here in the Phoenix metropolitan area. Our investigative priorities, I'd like to emphasize what they are, and one is, and they're not specifically in they're not prioritized in any specific order. These are our priorities here. Financial investigations, money laundering activities, and bulk cash. We certainly have investigators that will investigate the proceeds and the money that's used to facilitate crimes involving immigration or customs. A big priority here in this area, in this specific city, is the human smuggling, human trafficking. And again, I want to point out that what we do with the resources that I have is to go after the criminal organizations and the individuals that are and the infrastructure that support the criminal organizations, the smugglers, the coyotes, the stash houses. That infrastructure is what the agents, federal agents, do in pursuing prosecutions there. We also contraband smuggling, which is, that's the legacy customs part of the organization, is we were under customs responsible for drug investigations, similar to what DEA is responsible for, drug, where the difference between DEA and customs was involved in the international, any drugs that were smuggled into the United States, we investigated. We continue to investigate that now under ICE. DEA's more, has international and domestic. If we did not have a domestic piece, if the narcotics were produced domestically, that wasn't something customs got involved in. Where we had venue was because the drugs were smuggled into the United States. So and the majority of the contraband that we find here, narcotics here in the Arizona, we definitely has been smuggled in from international. Asset forfeiture, that's another big thing that we have a group of agents that specializes in going after the assets that have been identified that organizations acquire through their illegal businesses. And I would like to point out too that part of that pursuit of those assets is that we do asset sharing with agencies that partner with us and do investigations. We try to return back for their investment of their manpower to work with us in a case, any of the assets, through an asset sharing agreement, and get back to the state and local agencies that assisted us. A big priority is national security, making sure that we prevent any type of material from entering in the country. Again, that's part of our customs, legacy customs background, is we are in charge of securing the merchandise that enters in the country, make sure that anything that comes in or leaves the country is not coming in to do harm to the United States, and any technology that's leaving is not going to an enemy of ours to come back and hurt us at another date. We're really big into the cyber world. There's a lot, and you'd be surprised how many predators are international and domestic predators are on the net. And we have a group that works very aggressively, especially targeting the people that go after the most vulnerable victim, and that's children. Child pornography, very high priority of ours. Worksite enforcement, that is a very something that we're engaging more and more. The past under INS, there was more of the laws were applied civilly, and that program has not produced the result in reducing the demand for jobs, for that, you know, the draw, the magnet that brings people here. So we are definitely changing our focus and work site and going after businesses that knowingly hire and promote the and harbor, bringing illegals into the country to come work in their facilities, going after them criminally instead of going after them through fines. We found that the fine process, mainly some businesses looked at it as just the cost of doing business. So we're being much more aggressive. That's a change in our efforts. And we're going after the most egregious and having to prioritize those. We currently have a working group here in Phoenix that brought in multiple agencies together to identify the businesses that are the most egregious, and we're going to go after them, again, going after them criminally. And another component to worksite is to educate the employers. There's employers out there that can be duped or by subcontractors or individuals. And so we have an outreach program to help those businesses that do not want to be fall victims of some subcontractor, some person identifying themselves as a U.S. citizen. And then also the part about how they ask and protecting themselves on how they ask potential employees and not fall into discrimination type claims against them. So it's a two-prong on the work site. Fraud, we have a big effort in investigating fraud, and mainly here is the manufacturing and distribution of counterfeit identity, either for people to get immigration benefits or identity documents. This is where our office is located. We're at the Arizona Center. I want to talk a little bit about the partnership. Again, this part of Chief's, as he mentioned in his three-prong approach about collaboration. We have an excellent relationship. I could say this, that the first person who called me when I was appointed as a new special agent in charge from to be here in San Antonio was the chief. He called and welcomed me from when I was still in San Antonio, and I really appreciate that. And we've had a very good relationship, and we want to continue to build on with the city of Mesa. But again, to emphasize what we want to bring to the collaboration is go after smuggling organizations. We feel like we can be the most effective if we go after the smuggling organizations and the infrastructure that supports the smuggling, the stash houses, the hotels. There is a phenomenon that was here in Arizona, and I can say that we're starting to see a decline of these hostage and extortion cases. I don't know how much of this you all saw in the media, but it was an occurrence that was taking place far too frequently here in the Phoenix metropolitan area and in Mesa. I can also say, and I'll give some stats here in just a few minutes, of where a group of aliens was smuggled by one smuggler, put in a stash house, and then another smuggler would come try to rip off that load and take those aliens and extort money for them, smuggling fees again, and a lot of that produced tremendous violence. Those cases were recurring more than two a day. That has there's been a tremendous decline. There was one organization that was identified called the Franco Organization. There was over 150 members of that organization that were involved in the smuggling of the individuals, transporting them here, harboring them here, extorting the money. That organization, over 150 members were identified. They've been convicted either in state court, federal court, and have received long sentences. And I can say since I arrived here in October, we have not had one single case of that type of activity. So it's going after, you will be effective when you go after the organizations. Same thing with homicides and assaults. There was, you know, either we want to go after, that's part of this violence that's associated with this activity. Smuggling of aliens is a $1 billion business, and they will use whatever means they need to accomplish their goals. And the financial piece, it is, as I said, it's in the billions and of money. There's a lot of money. We want to go after that money. That's illegal money, and we want to take it from these criminals. This is, again, that's what I was referring to. Here in Mesa alone, of those kind of cases of stash houses, there was 20 in 04, there was 24 referrals from Mesa PD to ICE, six involved motels, In 05, there was 21, 9 involved motels. In 06, there was 31 and 11 involved motels. And that's a residence. And if you look at the windows of that residence, the next slide maybe, this is some of the kind of what we encounter when we go in there. Next one, Chief. This is kind of the conditions of these locations. That's the window, that resident. These people are held in there. They cannot, they're not at liberty to just leave. They bar them in there. And again, they do it for different reasons. They're afraid that another group's going to come rip them off. They want to extort money from them. They don't want them to leave. They take their shoes. A lot of times they take clothing from them so they can't leave. And this is the tools, part of the tools of the trade that they use to make this happen. And again, I bring this out because I want to emphasize that this is the these are the people that we need to impact, and we will have success if we can shut these people down. Again, the kind of firepower that they have. And this is what they do to some of the people that they have that they're holding. As I mentioned earlier, part of our priority is to protect the most vulnerable victims, and that's children. And through our cyber efforts in the child pornography area, we are very aggressive, and we have agents that work gang enforcement. We're talking to the chief, and again, as you mentioned, Councilman Scott Summers, there's one area where we have some we've been having some conversations about embedding an ICE agent with the chief to go after the criminal aliens that are in the Mesa area and the gang members. A financial investigation, we currently have a Mesa police officer that Chief Gascon. There's an investigation here. I can't talk because it's an ongoing investigation, but I can tell you that there is been identified over $300 million in money that's gone through a business here in the Mesa area that we believe that money is all alien smuggling related, and the chief has as one of his officers, one of the detectives, working very closely with us, and it's an ongoing case. I can't speak any more about it. This is a hotel, again, just the type of locations that these people are using. Notice this more. I want to talk a little bit about, again, part of the collaboration is some conversations that Chief and I have had about using one of ICE's databases or one of the systems that we have. It's called the LESC, the Law Enforcement Support Center. It's in Burlington, Vermont, and what it does, it gives access to state and local agencies on information that exists on immigration files, where if there's a person that's been previously deported and he's an aggravated felon, he's an absconder, or he's a wanted person, or he's wanted by ICE, one of our criminal investigations that we have, there's a query that can be done by state and local officers. It's an IAQ query. And I'll go a little bit more into that, but it is looking for these type of people, the people that are in your communities, that are aggravated felons that were previously deported, or they were served a notice to be removed and they haven't left the country, and those that have left and come back, and any kind of wanted person that we have in our files, in our investigative files. The support center, again, this is just a little diagram that just kind of tells how it works, you know, the interaction with state and locals and how queries can be done. I just go through. This is some information that I'd like to share with you that this is a system, law enforcement center here, Arizona, between 2004 and 2006, took over 110,000 queries from law enforcement agencies. It's staffed 24/7. And the other thing about it, it's a very secure network. Within, I think, in 2006, there averaged over 3,300 queries from 278 entities or organizations, police organizations in the state of Arizona. And Arizona is the number three user of this system, state of Arizona, and that's a nationwide system. Kind of some of the results in 2004 to 2005, there was 556 detainers lodged on criminals and wanted aliens. In 2006, it was 513 detainers were lodged in Arizona, and the average number of detainers in Arizona per month has risen from 34 to 43. And one of the things I will note is that there is another part of this system is a booking, is a kind of a blind booking system that when these are detainers that are placed and the numbers I just gave you there. But in addition to that, the jails that are involved with us, whenever there's an inmate that's foreign national, he's automatically run, and we get notified, and we send an agent, or we have agents in those facilities and handle those and place detainers for their removal. This is a totally different, the other numbers reflect where you have a police officer, he makes a call, and the LESC can place the detainer on him, where physically an agent from our office isn't there. Yeah. Just a little bit more about some of the agencies that are utilizing it than this slide. We can go to the next one. Kind of some of the successes, there's two. This one highlights about a person that an Arlington police officer ran through an IAQ, you know, because he was previously deported and he returned to the United States. That's a violation of the law to return when you've been deported. Not a voluntary removal. If you've been voluntarily removed and you come back, it's different. If you went through the system and you were deported and you come back to the United States, because you're barred from reentering the United States for up to 10 years, and if you enter, you're charged with a criminal offense. And this individual had done that, and the Arlington police officer ran and found him in our system. Agents did a case on him for reentry. He got 57 months in federal prison. But the significant thing, this person had been, he had multiple convictions for attempted murder, assaults, and drug crimes. This is the kind of guy we do not want on the streets. Houston recently experienced, unfortunately, the death of a police officer. I think this happened prior to my arrival here in October, shortly before I arrived. A Houston police officer arrested an illegal alien. He was in a patrol car, and somehow he was handcuffed and had a gun, and he shot the police officer. It was later determined that that person was in our system, but the Houston police had not run him, and he had had three previous encounters with law enforcement that they didn't run him through our system. It could have determined that he was a prior deport and wanted by immigration. This is the contact information for the LESC. Again, responses take, if a law enforcement agency engages these IAQ queries through immigration, they normally take 15 minutes to 2 hours. The average is 30 to 45 minutes. One of the things I talked to the chief to assure him is that if he has an officer on the side of the road and he's making an inquiry on this, that they make the inquiry is initially sent via a telex or a computer, but then they can make a phone call and say this is an urgent request because we have an officer on the side of the road, and they will expedite those requests. And again, I want to thank the council and the mayor and the chief and the public for having me here today.
And hopefully what we're doing, Mayor, is giving you an overview of not only the work that is going on in Mesa as far as the people, the things that we're doing, but the collaboration that is going on with other agencies, as well as some of the technology that we believe that would make us tremendously more efficient. The key here is how do we go after the criminal element, the people that are committing crimes, the people that are victimizing our communities, and how do we use all the other partners in the system. And Mr. Pena has, right off the gate, been extremely willing to provide us with a single point of contact, give us additional information, help us so that we can do those queries that we want to do from the field, as well as the partnership that he indicated that we have engaged in, that frankly up until this point it's an ongoing investigation, so we haven't really disclosed a lot of this information. But when I came here, I allowed one of our officers to go into this particular investigation, and as Mr. Pena indicated, it looks like this particular investigation is getting up into maybe $300 million in smuggling or more.
Okay. I very much appreciate you coming in and making the report. Is any council questions? Mike.
Thank you for coming over this morning. There's been some information in the news that perhaps that it may not be your division, but ICE is working with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office to do some cross-training within the jails, similar to what they do in L.A. County. Can you fill us in on how that's going and what type of work that person will be doing? It's not just for the undocumented. It's mostly to try to identify the criminal alien, I believe.
Yes, it's a program that in the jail situation, that will be, again, the other division that I listed on there, detention and removal, where there will be training for Maricopa County Sheriff's deputies to assist in the processing of inmates that are coming out, or when they come in, identifying them that they're potentially illegal in the country. They will be trained to help process. It's a force multiplier to detention and removals.
But also that would enable them to have access to the database on a criminal alien too, which is really what we're looking at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, I think that's what the chief and I have been talking about, is with the resources that we have, we'll have the greater impact going after the criminal alien. They're the ones that are causing the problems. They're the ones that contribute to the violence, to the activity that reduces the public safety, and that's who we want to go after.
And also important to get that word out to the immigrant community that we are looking for the criminal alien, which terrorizes that community as well as everybody else.
Correct.
Thank you.
Are you familiar with any other city programs under the 287G program where they're doing cross-training? I think that's the right.
Mayor, I'm not sure. The question, are you asking me if there's other cities that are engaged?
Well, I know that, like Mike mentioned, in some of the incarceration aspects of it, there are. But I didn't know if anybody else. I thought the governor with DPS was also doing something.
We're also currently in the process of negotiating an agreement with Maricopa County Sheriff for 287G to possibly have some of his patrol people or investigators with similar authority that immigration agents have. And also DPS has had some discussions with us about getting 287G. So there's two prongs, there's two pieces to it. There's the institutions in the jails, and then there's outside, either investigators or patrolmen, having some authority, being trained to be able to ask the kind of questions. And the utilization of it, in the agreements that we craft with them, is to utilize it in their scope of their duties. When they encounter somebody, they encounter a robber, a victim of homicides, and those type of, that they can ask immigration questions. They have the authority, they have the training, and they can ask the kind of questions. But it's to be utilized in the normal scope of their investigative work.
We had a council discussion on that and voted 5-2 not to proceed in that direction. So we're kind of abiding by that. I hope that the relationship that the police chief is trying to foster with ICE covers some of the same territory, but if at some point it would be beneficial, depending on budgets and what else, I hope that that opportunity would still be available to come back and revisit that issue.
And one of the things, Mayor, especially now that we have a single point of contact, our people are going to be further trained to enhance our capability to work with ICE when we are running into an investigation where we have a suspect that is potentially a criminal alien. We will have a single point of contact. What we're hoping to do is put all the tools that we can to fight crime. And one of the tools when we have a criminal alien is certainly using the immigration rules. By having a single point of contact 24/7, our investigators are going to be able to reach out very quickly and say, hey, we need your help. So in essence, even though we don't have the 287G capability, we're going to have an actual ICE investigator that will be working with us immediately in order to process that information. We believe that we could be just as effective by doing it this way.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much for the presentation.
My pleasure.
Did bring something for you and the mayor.
The next item is to hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on changes to the major general plan amendment process.
Good morning. Good morning, Mayor, Council. As stated, we're here this morning to talk to you a little bit about our major general plan amendment process. We just had the opportunity to utilize this process over the last year to evaluate a major general plan request, and through that, again, gained some understanding of what has been working with that process, maybe what hasn't been working, and had some feedback from some of the council members desiring for the council to have a greater opportunity to impact and review those requests as they come forward instead of so much of it happening just right at the end. So we've looked at this process with those ideas in mind and want to visit with you today about two different areas of changes that we'd like your consideration on. The first would be some changes or amendments to the general plan itself as it refers to the definition of what is a major general plan and also requirement on hearing and considering the applications at one meeting. Then also to review the application package as we have it drafted. We've changed a few of those procedures in there in order to give council and P&Z a little bit more opportunity to impact those. So we're going to go through each of those items separately. First is the definition of a major plan amendment. Currently, as you know, we have major amendments and we have minor amendments. The major differences between the major and the minor amendments is the major amendment requires a 60-day review period, as stated in state statute, and it also requires that the council hear all of those applications that are submitted in one calendar year during that same calendar year at a single public hearing. And so that puts some restrictions on how we can process those particular types of applications and those procedures that we view. It's a lot more rigid than with the minor plan amendments that can come any time of the year. They're processed typically right along with the zoning case. If there's a desire to change those, it's a lot more, it's easier to make changes to those, potentially to send them back to P&Z than it would be with a major amendment. You know, maybe a downside of changing the definition or making more things minor amendments is minor amendments maybe typically get a little bit less scrutiny than a major amendment, don't get quite the public attention that a major amendment gets, doesn't have that 60-day review period. So that would be part of the consideration that would go in there. State statutes provide a little bit of direction on what a major amendment is supposed to be. It says that a major amendment is a substantial alteration of the municipality's land use mixture or balance. That's as much direction as we get from the state statute. We've reviewed what some of the other cities in the Valley use for their definitions of major amendments and have those in your report. Basically, there's a pretty big range. Glendale model has a matrix that goes every place from 20 acres to 320 acres, depending upon where it is in the community and the type of change it is. The other extreme might be Phoenix, where you have to be at least 3 square miles, in most cases 5 square miles, before they consider it a major plan amendment. They have not done any major plan amendments in Phoenix because of that size definition that they have. The current criteria that we have in the city of Mesa, if you're currently residential land use designation and you're 40 acres or more and want to change to another land use classification, we call that a major amendment. If you're non-residential, if you're some type of employment designation currently and you want to go to residential, then it's even smaller, it's 20 acres. Anything else, if you're going from a residential to residential or employment to employment, it can be 320 acres. And we also have a requirement in there in terms of any modifications to freeways or arterial, limit arterial streets and so forth. That's our current definition. Over the last 4 years since we've adopted the current general plan, we've had 5 applications for major plan amendments. You can see 2 of those have been withdrawn, 1 denied, and 2 have been approved. You can see the size acreage in those that we've had from around 300 acres to the largest one, the one we just did on the Levine property, which is almost 1,500 acres. One of the major emphasis of the current plan is the improved sustainability of the city of Mesa, to improve the jobs to housing mixture in the city so we can be more sustainable. So in consideration of this, staff looked at that particular idea. And we looked at the fact that within our general plan, we do have designated economic activity areas, and those are areas that we particularly are trying to encourage and promote economic development and provide places for jobs and employment to occur. And so we want to make sure if we make any changes that we are maintaining those areas as solidly as we can for employment. And we found that the current definition that we have, particularly that standard on if you're currently employment, it's and you want to go to residential, if it's more than 20 acres, it's a major plan amendment. That's discouraged some people in these employment areas from wanting to come in and make that kind of change because of the rigors of a major plan amendment. So we think that's been helpful to us to date in preserving those employment areas. So with that in mind, we have looked at some possible changes that would like to start with today. Whatever we do in terms of an amendment to the plan, will become a minor plan amendment itself. We'll have to take through P&Z, and so we'll have the opportunity to discuss these ideas further with them. But as a place to start, what staff would recommend is that we keep the current definition, with one exception that I'll mention amendment in a minute, to the economic activity areas, the 40 acres from residential to some other use, the 20 acres from non-residential to residential, and then the 320 acres. But then for everywhere else in the city, that we just use that last definition of any change that involves 320 acres or larger, that's what it would take to become a major amendment. So again, that would give the potential for more changes to occur in those areas and still be minor amendments and have that more flexible process for both the Planning and Zoning Board and Council to use. The other change that we're wanting to propose is that we eliminate the fourth criteria that we currently have about modifications to freeways or limited arterials. Those are not supposed to be that solidly defined to begin with. Most of them are built in discussions with Transportation Division. Nobody's really sure why that's there, and we would propose just to take that out for the future. In addition to those changes to the definition of a major plan amendment, there's also a statement in section 14.2.2 of the general plan that lays out the process for general plan amendments. It says the council is to hear and consider major plan amendments at one hearing. That's a little bit different than the state statute, which just said you should hear them at one meeting. We're proposing that we take out that and consider phrase, so that again it gives council a bit more flexibility and be able to hear a case, if necessary, continue that public hearing to a future meeting, so that we can continue to work with the applicant on any modifications. So again, making any of those changes to the general plan document itself will require a minor general plan amendment to be processed. It's our suggestion, if we can get the direction and support of council to do those, that we would begin that process with a discussion at P&Z next week, then formally begin the process so that we can take it to P&Z at their February meeting, hopefully get their approval at that time, have it back here to council in March. That way it could be in place before the April deadline for this year's applications. From here, we're going to move to the discussion of the process, and so I want to see if you had any questions at this point about those major general plan amendments and how we might change the plan document itself.
The map that you showed, this one, yes, here, is that what you're referring to as figure 4-2?
Yes, that's currently, Mayor, in the general plan. So it's adopted by the council already, and a very clear definition of those economic development activity areas.
Okay, so we're almost taking a little bit off the Glendale model, but we're doing it off the employment aspects.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Any questions on anything? Kyle?
I understand the reasoning behind keeping down to the 20 acres for the classification. Just because of the complexity of doing a major amendment, Gilbert, their smallest major amendments are 40 acres. Phoenix is really huge. Would it just simplify to go to 40 acres for our minimum, have it the same both ways? That's a big process to go through for people who are trying to make a difference. I mean, if it's that critical, we could stop it in a minor amendment if we needed to. The difference between a major and a minor is how many votes you have to get and the process to go through.
Right, Mayor, Councilmember Jones, that is one other change that, or difference that I didn't mention before, is that the major amendments do require that supermajority that a minor amendment does not require. The 60-day review period, the requirement for the single hearing of all major cases at the council level, is a difference between the major and the minor amendments. Going back to the state statute statement that a major amendment should be a substantial change to the mixture, land use mixture and balance in the community, given a 170 square mile planning area, when you're down at 20 or 40 acres, that kind of change, generally speaking, doesn't seem like it would have a substantial impact on that land use mixture, and with maybe that exception of the employment activity areas that are so important for the city. That's why we were looking at that difference.
But the way it's worded, I mean, you have a specific employment activity area, Williams Gateway, that sort of a deal of trying to change from business to residential, but other parts of the city where you might have a commercial area that has been sitting and they want to change it to residential, and if it happens to be 21 acres, they have to go through a major plan amendment.
Correct. Yes, Councilmember Jones, that's correct under today's definition. We're proposing to change that so it'd be easier, go up to 320 acres.
Okay, so as long as it's outside those designated employment centers.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because the way I read that, it was just saying if you're changing from, where was it at? Anyway, I was thinking it was saying if you change it from just a designation other than what it is, so it's not necessarily the zoning as much as the general plan area that we're talking
Correct.
About on that map.
Correct.
Okay. Then that works for me. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions there? If not, we'll move on.
Well, what I'm seeing is there's a couple of applications, or at least one pending, that is now in like 19 acres of apartment buildings underneath the flight pattern so that there's not 20.
Right.
So that's what...
yes, Mayor, it's kind of interesting how that number works out and be just less than whatever the general plan designation is. So a consideration may be you want to make that even smaller and make it 10 or 15 acres or whatever on yeah. those. But
we had a suggestion up here, any change, if it goes, just make in those areas actually have it zero. So if you do want residential, you have to come through with a major plan amendment and justify it.
And we could sure look at that, too, if that's the direction the council would like to give.
I actually, support that. I think that if we're making a statement that this is non-residential areas because it's in a flight path, or you're trying to protect your other commercial or your business development and have compatible uses, that any residential infringement in that, I think, is a change to your philosophy on job to housing and setting those areas aside. So I think it's something that I would like at least some discussion with P&Z. See if there's a concurrence.
Scott. In our little sidebar, I'd also like to throw in on that number one, any change in residential land use of 40 or more contiguous acres to another land use classification as another effort to encourage a higher level of job to resident ratio. Perhaps we could increase it above 40 acres to say 100 or 160 based on, looks like Glendale and Peoria models. And that way, if you were interested in taking a residential use and changing it to a commercial use or a job center, we will allow you a minor general plan amendment for a greater area. So balance those two. I think zeroing it out, any change to a residential use, major general plan amendment, and then taking the acreage for switching from residential to a job center and making it larger.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, we'll be glad to look at both of those ideas as we move through the P&Z level and actually create then that minor plan amendment that we'll process back through. One of the reasons that at this point I had proposed leaving it the same with the 40 acres in those employment areas is that there is some desire, we're recognizing more and more, for that mixture of uses to occur. And we've kind of got a relationship established already of employment to residential in those areas. And so I was looking, maybe we didn't want to allow too much change the other way either, but we'll look at both of those and see how they look as we come back.
Okay, and the other one that we probably need to do is run some type of, we've done the financing in the future and do some type of economic model. If we're really successful and all these are just employment uses, and I'm not sure what kind of retail mix would be in with that, but we may not be sustainable if, again, our revenue bases don't generate as much from an employer as they might from a retail or some other activity. So I'm doing this with a little bit of caution. I still like the idea of having job to housing ratio at build out, but if what you need is more retail and more to be successful, then you need more high density housing next to the retail so you have more shoppers. So I'm not quite sure that I know the build-out balance for the community, and I'm not sure how you run that model or if you can, but it's something that I think we need to give serious consideration on. Are we on a path where we can sustain to provide services to a business that really doesn't contribute back financially to the city outside of the state shared income tax that we get a little bit of and then the utilities? So that's a question I have that needs to somehow be analyzed in this mix.
Mayor, we'll see if we can look at that too.
All right.
Okay.
Other questions or comments on the suggestions? Mike.
Along that same line, would there be any type of a development agreement or a zoning capability to where we could perhaps have a kind of community facilities district for those buildings that we could get a property tax from that particular building development? Is there some way to work through that to where that business would pay for itself, not subject the whole community to a property tax, but only those areas within that business park? I don't know if that's legal. Christy, have you used those?
Well, the challenge with the commercial facilities districts is that it really only allows for the facility construction to finance the construction of the facilities. And as we know, that's only one part of the ultimate cost of services. That ongoing services, personnel costs, it really becomes a challenge for us. So I certainly think there's some opportunities to look at that model, but in the end of the day, it doesn't solve the problem because then we don't have the ongoing operations cost to sustain.
What you would get only would be the initial infrastructure.
Yeah, and that's the limitation by state law, as I understand it, is really it's limited to the facility side of it.
The other aspect of doing the, like the Verado and others, where they actually have a property tax assessment for the infrastructure improvements, is then you're going to have parts of the city that have it and parts that don't. If we ever did want to go to an election and have a citywide one, then you'll have a component that says, well, we've already paid or we're already paying. Maybe at some point, if we've given up on ever doing it, but that's another nuance to it that I've kind of run into, and I've tried to run that scenario. Right. Yes, Scott.
I think part of the solution to that might be to make sure that, I don't know how it quite works in Verado, but a lot of these development agreements, if I'm not mistaken, combine city infrastructure with a rock gym that the city has no interest in. And to separate those two out so that the community improvement district or the facilities improvement district includes only municipal services, and that if this city were ever to decide through an election that there was going to be a property tax, then the FID would go away and be sustained by the property tax.
It might be a hybrid to it somehow. Okay.
All right, then we'll move on to the next part of the report and presentation. That has to do with the process itself and how we've done it in years previous and the changes we're proposing for this year. The first slide just runs through quickly the major dates and steps of the process. During this time frame that we're in right now is the time when a person can come in, make a pre-submittal meeting with staff. We can review with them the process and procedures, make sure what they're talking about really is a major plan amendment, make sure they understand the steps. The first formal submittal is due April 16th. Follow-up submittal due May 31st. 60-day review period is scheduled from June 13th to August 13th. First P&Z hearing is September 6th. Submittal of modifications, if they have any, from that point, September 21st. Then from there, staff evaluates, prepares a report. P&Z has their second hearing October 18th. The change that we've had from the previous year is we're listing more general council hearing date, November or December. What we had done previously is said we wouldn't come to council until December. That gave P&Z the opportunity to continue the case to their November meeting to continue to work on it. They could still do that this time, but if they should go ahead and take action in October, then we can go ahead and schedule in November and not have quite such a downtime between P&Z and council, so the application can move a little bit more quickly through the process. In terms of the involvement of different bodies, citizen involvement, currently we've required two public meetings to happen before a first formal submittal. Now we're suggesting it, but making it optional before they make a first formal submittal. Currently, we require a public hearing or the applicant to go to a neighborhood meeting between their first and second submittals. We're continuing to require that in the new process. And then also to require them to go to the citizens during that 60-day review period to let them know what they actually filed and what's being reviewed and get any feedback they might have from the citizens during that time. In the next section, the P&Z and council involvement, major change that we're proposing for this coming year is that during May, we would bring what has been submitted in that first submittal to council and to P&Z. So the you can get a presentation on what's being proposed at that time and provide any high-level feedback to the applicants. Anything that you see as being a significant issue that they need to consider, might want to change in that application to make it more acceptable to you. They can take that information from the citizens, from the PNC board, and from council during that time between the first and second formal submittals, and then use that to make any modifications they desire when they make that final second submittal at the end of May. When we do get that final submittal in May, both the PNC and council will receive a copy of those submittals, so you can see at that point what they did actually go ahead and do and make as their submittal. The PNC will continue to have their two hearings, so it's required by the state statute, and then it will come to council for the hearing again in November or December. So that's the opportunities, the formal opportunities that those boards will have for impacting the process and the application. We've also modified a little bit the wording in the packet as to the types and level of modifications that can occur in an application at various points in the process. In the current process that we've used this last year, because of the emphasis on the citizen involvement early on, we were trying to start really limiting the amount of modification an applicant could make after that first submittal. We've changed that, and basically they can make any changes they want up to that second submittal based on the input they're receiving from the citizens, from this board, and from PNZ. Once they make that formal submittal, though, and we go to that 60-day review period, that's out there. What they submitted is out there for review, so there's really no changes that an applicant can make at that point. But then when we get to the first PNZ hearing, and the applicant at that point is getting the results of the 60-day review period, they have any discussion that goes on at planning and zoning. Based on what they hear at that time, we're allowing them to make non-substantial changes to their application. In the previous form, we've tried to put some standards in there of what we think non-substantial is. Those get very difficult to work with. We're leaving it more open at this time, and basically we're looking at, is the change they're proposing going to be so different from what went through the 60-day review period that people wouldn't be able to look at it and say it's the same application? And it's the planning director has the wonderful opportunity to make that decision if those changes are being proposed and determine where that line is. But we'll try to be as flexible as we can, but still not allow the application to change so much that people would not have really been thinking about those things when they were looking at the earlier reviews. So they can make those changes, and then that's what staff would be using as their final request to review and provide the report to P&Z on. P&Z then will hear the case, and again, using that same basic standard, the Planning and Zoning Board will be able to work with the applicant based on what they hear to make modifications to that application in terms of what they recommend on to the council, as long as they don't change it so much, kind of same criteria as to what's gone through the review to that point, that people wouldn't be able to recognize it as the same case, not, you know, bring up something totally new. From there, once P&Z makes their recommendation, what we're trying to have happen is that's what gets presented to council, so that the applicant's not coming to you and trying to present something different. At your hearing, however, as you hear the presentation from the applicant, from staff, and from the citizens, be a similar level as at P&Z, if there's changes that this board then feels like need to be made to the application in order to make it acceptable and approvable and furthering the goals of the plan, then you can make those changes in it, as long as it doesn't change it so much from what P&Z has provided you a recommendation on that we've now got basically a different application. Again, planning director gets the opportunity to make that decision when we've crossed that line into making decisions that really make it a different case and something different than what P&Z has made a recommendation on. We have talked a lot about, as staff, can we send cases back to the Planning and Zoning Board? And state statute, the way it's worded about the council holding a single public hearing at one time during the year, has caused us to, that along with some of the notification requirements, 60-day review period and so forth, feel like we really can't do that with a major plan amendment. We believe council can continue their public hearing to subsequent public hearing to consider changes and modifications, but we can't really change it so much as to send it back to P&Z for further review. That complicates it too much on a major amendment. So that's where we are. And let's see here. There should have been one more slide there, I think, but I don't know where it went. It was just to say what questions, direction do you have for us at this point.
Did you try to look at the time frame at all in which there would be an opportunity to kind of crunch it at the beginning, do the 60 days, relook at it, and then have a 60-day window that you could still go back if you had to?
Mayor, council members, we have looked at, and we could in future years, starting next year, back the whole process up so we get our applications in January. So we're looking, doing that pre-submittal time during the end of 2007 and start the real application process in January and get to council in August or September. We could do that. We can't do that this year because it'd be too late to notify people that they should be getting their applications in right now. But we can sure do that. That might give us a little bit more flexibility at that end of the year about how much time council can continue to consider a case and do it within that same calendar year. We still don't see if that helps us to be able to send it back to the Planning and Zoning Board because of the issues I brought up a moment ago.
Right, and there may be some that need to go back and others that don't. So I'm just trying to figure out if there was a way to time that out. And maybe the following year that might be something that I would encourage entertaining so that if substantial changes are made, that the citizens have that another 60-day period to take a look at it. Because I think what may happen now is you may get played a little bit on this thing where they keep thinking, well, you can make pretty close to substantial changes and we'll just not give our best shot for sure because we can modify it, and if we have to back off, we'll back off after, you know, a couple of different attempts to it. So I'm not sure what the balance is on that, but it seems to be that one of the balances could be goes through one public hearing, not a lot of changes, it goes up to council and we'll vote on it. If there's a lot of controversy and you play games and want more and more and do a modification, then it has to go through a whole another 60-day review period. So that would be my goal, is to try to get there if we could.
Okay. Mayor, and again, and I don't know if Debbie wants to jump in or not, but the state statutes in terms of that 60-day review period, the notice, and again, council hearing those at a single public hearing, we haven't figured out how you could continue a public hearing long enough to go back through P&Z in that 60-day review period and then bring it back and still consider that a single public hearing, as opposed to you have it and the council continues to keep it and, you know, just continue it for a meeting or two. That's where we've run into the difficulty of being able to really send it back through a 60-day review period or P&Z.
Well, you may have one single public hearing and then you have an option to start over the process, and then you have on a new, almost because it's substantial enough that it's a new submittal virtually to run through again within that calendar year. It's just one concept that I think has a little merit. Okay. Other comments, discussion on this? Yes.
Briefly, I think something we need to address, not necessarily right now, is define what exactly non-substantial is. We've Port Debbie's office was just spinning around during this last soiree to try to figure out whether or not we could do a partial approval, which is ultimately what we ended up doing. So I think having a little bit narrower definition of what exactly a non-substantial is, we can have some discussions on that, and making sure that we include in that, since we figured out we could do a partial approval, stating that in the application that the council has the option to approve the plan in whole or in part.
So. Mm-hmm. Good idea. Okay. All right, it goes to P&Z next then?
Mayor, in terms of the minor plan amendments, we will be working on those through the P&Z board with the goal of having that back here in March for action, so we'll be able to affect applications that might come in this year. In terms of the procedure, if council is basically satisfied with that, we will bring that back probably next Thursday so you can formally approve that. We didn't agendize it that way today. We want to see what comments you have, but get your actual approval of that time frame and process next week.
Okay, Mike?
When do we redo the whole plan? Is it 2012? Is it 10 years from our last approval?
Yes.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments on this? Okay, thank you. Do you have any other direction you need? Are you okay? All right, okay. Item number three, acknowledging receipt of minutes of various boards and committees. We have three in front of us today. Have a motion and second for acknowledging receipt. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes. The reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Yep, Scott.
Thank you, Mayor. Chief Gascon and I attended a meeting yesterday at Sunland Springs Village.
with the purpose of building public safety partnerships and security. It was very well attended. There were well over 100 people in attendance. I'd say close to 200 folks out there very interested in it. Good to see a lot of very successful block watch programs going on out there. And I'd be interested to know if they filled all the red dots so that they have block watch captains in every neighborhood, but because there was a long line of folks ready to fill them in. So that was good to see.
Good. Anyone else? Then scheduling of meetings and general information, Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Let me hand out two different pieces of information here. Just a reminder to the council that we will have our next council or study session will be January 18th, and then we'll have a January 22nd study session and council meeting. I'm handing two items of information passing out. One is the schedule of the town hall meetings that'll be coming up January 23rd through February 28th with the different districts and the locations. So we pass that out for your information. And then also today, like to announce, or Ms. Kent is actually announcing today that her appointment on a permanent basis, we've removed the interim title from Mr. Villa. He'll be named as the, Ray Villa will be named as the city's co-compliance officer, so we want to congratulate him on that. He's done a tremendous job in his position. How long has it been now, Ray, that you've been on the interim position?
6 months.
So I told him in 6 months we would take a look at things and decide whether we're going to go out for a national search, and we looked out around as far as we could, and we found the best one right here. So we've decided to appoint Ray to be our co-compliance officer. He's done a great job in that area. We look forward to working with him in that area. So those are the announcements I have this time, Mayor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you ask him?
Are there any requests to speak this morning?
I have none, Mayor.
Okay. Then the study session is adjourned. Thank you.